So the basic questions that I was asking myself as the ACA got rolled out, and I have to say I participate in a couple of organizations that have been actively involved in health reform. Again, I'm a past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, which supports single payer as the solution to our, or as part of the solution to our health care troubles. It goes beyond that into our politics as well. But I also participate in other organizations that work at, were working hard to try and make sure that the ACA was implemented in Ohio, where I am from, which has kind of become a quasi-red state of sorts. So I do participate in other organizations where the ACA is, we're trying to do the best with it that we can. And in the process of looking at the ACA, they have a whole bunch of reforms that are embedded in the ACA, which the proposal was that they would save money, improve quality, expand access. I mean, we know the ACA will expand access to some extent. But I'm going to go through some of these things because, believe it or not, there was a fair amount of data about some of these things that were out there almost at the time this stuff was being thought through and implemented, and none of it supported any of, I shouldn't say any, but the majority of the ideas that are part of the ACA. So I'm just going to go through that data for you, and you can make up your own minds about whether we're going to get where we want to go through the ACA. As hard as all of us work to try and get an additional health expansion, and although it will be a blessing, particularly Medicaid, maybe a blessing for a fair number of families and individuals who never were able to get it before, I think it isn't going to get us where we want to go in terms of having a true health care system that focuses on keeping us all healthy. So I have no financial interest. These guys do. I don't. So what it says is, will the real death panelists still please stand up? You got the insurance industry, the drug industry, the Dems, the GOP, the hospital industry. So these guys do have financial interests in this ballpark. Remember, we spend $3 trillion every year on healthcare, borderline, give or take $100 billion or so. It's a lot of money. As commented earlier, you can get somebody professionally killed up in Detroit for about $15,000. This is a lot of money at stake. They're not going to want things to change. So you have to be recognizing that these individuals are going to have a lot of a lot more power than we do, but we've got the people if we want to organize them and make it happen, and that'll be my conclusion, I'm sure. So let's look at some of the insurance reforms that were proposed. They said the insurance exchanges, they would cause insurers to compete on quality of service, standard benefit packages, and competition, and that would control costs. That risk adjustment for the insurers, so if you picked up sick people, risk corridors, which are like given age groups, you'd have a different premium for different age groups, and reinsurance, which means that if you have really sick people, the insurance companies have insurance. I don't know if you know that, but if you didn't know that, you need to know that, that they all buy insurance on their high-cost cases. So it could be at $100,000, could be $200,000, but if that case goes over, then they have an insurance company who pays them to make up the cost. So they're even insuring beyond the insurance. And then we have the limits on administrative costs, so-called medical loss ratio. Giving you care is considered a loss to an insurance company. That's what it means. That's what they call it, the medical loss. They provided medical care. That was a loss to them. What they get to keep in their pocket is the rest. And the Affordable Care Act actually set that loss at 15% for large insurers, 20% for small individual insurance. So we've limited it at right about the not too distant within a percentage point or two of where they were functioning anyway. So these limits are really, you know, how limits sometimes can become ceilings. Well, the exchanges, I don't know if I need to say much. I mean, this is a historical mess of gigundous proportions. You all heard of it on the news. And the costs of this clumsy start are unmeasured. The number of people who failed to get coverage, the delays in coverage, the amount of money that it took to straighten out the systems that were screwed up to begin with. And in all honesty, I want to be fair, this mess was going to happen. Everybody knew it was going to happen because there are so many moving parts in a healthcare system that you have to coordinate across and so many different databases that you have to coordinate across to even begin to do something like an insurance exchange. I remember in many days before when I was organizing in the Clinton era, someone had a Rube Goldberg machine, basically, that was the description of our sickness care non-system. And, you know, expecting something to plop out the other end of the Rube Goldberg machine, which is your health care, is pretty foolish. Simple is better. Compare the smooth start of Medicare. When Medicare went into place in 1965, they enrolled almost 20 million people on postcards. Because it was that simple. The question was, Are you a citizen? If you are you over 65? If you are, here's your Medicare card. Done. One simple system, similar benefits for everyone. Simple is better. Even with navigators, it's difficult to assess and compare benefits and coverage and access to desired caregivers. All of these different insurance companies within the exchanges have different contracts with different hospitals, different networks of providers, whether it's physical therapy, equipment, pharmacy, all these things are different within each of these different programs, even though in terms of how much of your bill they're supposed to pay, they may be similar. The parts of the bill they'll pay could be different. Just the bottom line that you would pay as a consumer needs to be the same. So it's called the actuarial value of the policy. So it's 60% if it's bronze, 70% if it's silver, 80% if it's gold. But it doesn't say what part of your bill is going to be covered. So every one of these things makes it very complicated. And having looked at this with some of my own patients, who I take care of poor people, and having looked through some of the information they're providing me, I got 20 years of schooling, and I'm on the day shift on this one, as Bob Dylan would say. I really don't know what to tell them. I mean, I know more about health insurance. I've practiced for about 10 years as a medical director for an HMO. I can't advise my patient about what's best for them. You know, it's, again, simple is better. This is way too complicated. So what's going to happen? This is more of a prediction, but we've seen it happen with other HMO sort of private insurance-based stuff. They're still going to market to healthy people. 10% of the patients generate 70% of the healthcare costs. 5% of the patients generate 50% of the healthcare costs. So if you're an insurer and you've got a population and you can avoid 1% of that 5%, you'll have 20% more money in your pocket. If you take 1% more of that 5%, you'll have 20% less money in your pocket. It's basically the difference between life and death for an insurance company is the type of people you enroll. And to some extent, even though there are all these risk adjustments, they're not really all that effective. And you're still going to have the use of the money that you don't put out there, even if at some point they make you kick back more. Whatever money you can keep in your bank account or in your stock investments is going to make more money for you the longer you can keep it in your pocket. So they're still going to market to attract healthy people. It'll still be to their advantage, even with some of these restrictions that Obamacare put on board. And we know it's true because we've seen it with the HMO industry in the past. The other thing they're doing is exaggerating. They're going to have this risk adjustment now to keep people from what's called cherry picking. You get the healthy and lemon dropping, which is the sick, right? To keep them from cherry picking and lemon dropping, supposedly they're going to have risk adjustment. So what these companies are doing now, the insurance companies, are hiring doctors to go into their clients' homes and identify borderline marginal arthritic sort of problems. I mean, how many people here are over 60? How many of you have a joint that aches? And I saw one guy put his hand down. He doesn't have a joint. I mean, they're going in, and now they've got a new diagnosis, arthritis. Are they doing anything for the arthritis? Are they treating them for the arthritis? No. But they're going into the homes, and actually teams of doctors and nurses identifying additional issues that they can put on their risk score so that they can trump up the amount of money that they're going to get within that risk adjustment. So they're going to game the system. They're doing it now in Obamacare. Now they've done it before. They'll do it again. The other thing, as I mentioned, networks that don't cover safety net providers. I had a patient recently who was on an Obamacare plan, one of the silver plans, which is too terrible, and he needed a dermatologist. This is Toledo, Ohio. The dermatologist he could see was in Cleveland, 95 miles away. That was the dermatologist in their network that he could see. So bottom line on it is they're gonna find ways to avoid providing care to people and reduce what they're spending on patients, and they've got all kinds of ways of doing it. The other thing that we know that they're doing now, at least in terms of these limits on administrative costs, is they're beginning to call things that used to be overhead, and part of this, they're calling it care now. So they were able to convince the regulators that care management, which was a lot of the stuff like sending these doctors into the home to trump up the sickness, that was direct patient contact, and that ought to not be part of their administrative costs. They're going to game the system. They do it. They did it before. They'll do it again. it isn't going to be adequate to just try and throw these rooms. And the lastly, will the 15% be the rule for those people that were more efficient before? There were a few in our state. When I looked, we had a couple 12 and 13% overhead. You know, are they simply going to say, well, why are we working so hard? We'll get 15%. You know, so will it actually become, you know, the rule rather than the, you know, something that's a limit? Well, actually, we had some information about this stuff because even here, this is stuff that was published about what was going on a good bit of time earlier than the implementation of Obamacare, which is over in Europe, in Switzerland and the Netherlands. They were already using insurance exchanges. And there was information about insurance exchanges that was already rolling out in the literature in Europe. And this is kind of a summary of that literature that was actually published in 2012. Any of you who have published know that what's in 2012 is at least a year or two earlier. So this information was out there about the exchanges. So here, just focusing on the bolds here. Competitive insurance markets will not contain costs without reforms of the healthcare purchasing market. Okay? So the exchanges aren't any good if you don't have a way to make sure that the purchasers know what they're buying, right? Which goes right back to this narrow network stuff and the complexity of trying to choose plans within an exchange. The results so far in terms of cost containment, quality improvement have been negligible. And this was about 10 years of experience with playing around with markets in Switzerland and in the Netherlands. With some of these other restraints even, with things like restraints on profits and restraints on the narrowness of networks and other things along that line. Actually better networks than we had. So, insurance exchanges, they ain't going to work. It's not going to control costs. It's not going to improve quality. There's data out there. And yet, think about the money that we're spending to support these. The estimate is that everybody who purchases insurance through an exchange is probably going to be about 2% or more extra added on just for the administrative costs of the exchanges. And no one knows what the cost of regulating this bad behavior that undoubtedly is going to occur will cost us. As the Swiss and Dutch experience demonstrates, these reforms take time, require mid-course corrections. We should expect them to be a work in progress for many years to come with uncertain outcomes. Oh, that's encouraging. Sobering message is inescapable. Although exchanges will help greatly to cover previously uninsured people, cost containment, quality improvement are not outcomes to be expected from exchanges alone. They ain't going to work, guys. This is not the answer. Provider incentives. Well, they said, well, let's see. The providers are fee-for-service is driving up costs. We're over-providing services. It kind of ignores the actual data, which if you actually look at, Americans get fewer hospital days. We get fewer doctor visits. About the only thing we have extra, you know, is, well, we got extra people in prison. I won't go there. But, you know, we have extras of other things like technology, but then there's even some evidence that maybe we overuse that technology. So it's nice to have extra, but maybe that encourages overuse. But one of the things they said we should do is bundle payments. There's actually a bundled payment expert in the audience here. Maybe she can comment on this stuff. But the bottom line on it is that bundled payments have been tried in other places. Not necessarily for the simplest things, like joint replacement, which I think she's an expert in, but in things like diabetes management, hypertension management, things like this. And they've been tried over in the National Health Service in England for quite a while now. Accountable care organizations and pay-per-performance, we'll talk about that. A little bit more about the exchanges and then price transparency. So here's some more lessons from the Netherlands, 2011. Again, we all know if you're publishing data, it's probably from the 5 to 10 years before again. So this stuff is out there. In 2007, I'll emphasize that, bundle payment concept was approved for nationwide implementation for diabetes, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and vascular risk management. Differences in prices were only partly explained by actual differences in care. So when a bundled payment group, a group that took on bundled payment, had a difference in price, it wasn't necessarily because they were providing better care or different care. They've actually found that various of these insurers who were taking bundled payments from the government were actually stinting on care to contain costs. This goes right back to the old HMO idea where, you know, again, if you're at risk, our giving you care is a cost to us. And so when you hand that insurance function to clinicians, there's a good chance some of them will behave the same way as the insurers will, you know, regardless of their having taken an oath to protect their patients. So in the Netherlands, no substantial changes in outcome indicators. So they tried bundled payment. It didn't make that much difference in outcome. Now, maybe they weren't doing it as well, or maybe it was a more complex bundle than something straightforward like a joint replacement, but at least there, it didn't seem to work very well. And questions were raised about the in Netherlands specifically, about the conflict of interest that was there when these physician groups took on these patients and took bundled payments for things like for COPD and diabetes. That again, maybe they were starting to do the lemon drop and cherry pick sort of activities that the insurers were doing before, to get the easier to manage patients. Once again, you know, so you know, could you risk adjust down to that level? So now you got another administrative burden. You're trying to risk adjust not at an insurance company level across a fairly large population, but now down to subpopulations of that population. And who's going to police that? Who's going to organize that? Who's going to look at that? So the other problem was an unforeseen side effect that the Dutch found. These care groups led to decreased freedom of choice of provider, which was exactly the opposite of what most of us would want. So all of a sudden, because they've gone into these bundles and you've got diabetes, your primary care doctor has joined up with this diabetes specialist, you know, at the center of excellence that you're hooked up with as a bundled care provider. But that's not the diabetes specialist you were seeing before, you know. Instead of in Amsterdam, you're going to Utrecht or whatever, and now all of a sudden you can't see your diabetes because the bundle payment is, you know, so you're having to do these changes. And even if the care was good when you got to the new expert, there's still the break of continuity and everything else that would be problematic. Improvements in the care delivery processes and transparency of delivered care, antitrust concerns, limited choice for patients, all these things again surfaced in the Netherlands experiment. In addition, several still key unknowns, how best to take, again, risk adjustment, coexisting conditions into account, how to avoid lemon dropping and cherry picking, shifting costs of patient services outside your bundle, and what that overall effect would be on costs. These guys have been working at it from 2007. It doesn't work. It's complicated. We need simple. How about pay for performance? I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Pay for performance suggests that manipulating greed, a fuel that's powered exponential growth and productivity in the overall economy, but even Adam Smith said that a commodity production required a parallel public service economy driven by social duty. I mean, all of us in this audience who are physicians and some of us who are nurses probably took an oath. And that oath is to put the interests of our patients ahead of our own, not to put our profits ahead of the interests of our patients. So that social duty was even recognized by, you know, the guru of market economies, Adam Smith. And this is a quote from an article by Steffi Woolhandler, and those of you who came here to hear me are sampling my water for her wine. She's actually getting the Avidas Donabedian Award at this very moment. So I feel bad that I can't be there to see her get it. But comment here, sadly, greed has caused many of the worst abuses within the current system. Injecting a different monetary incentives into healthcare can certainly change it, but not necessarily in the ways that policymakers would plan, much less hope for. So, again, what have we found? In the OECD, World Health Organization actually looked at the implications of these sort of pay-for-performance things across all the OECD countries, 19 rich countries of the world, to look at how they were handling these pay-for-performance incentives. Pay-for-performance does not lead to breakthrough quality improvements, and performance measures and other key building blocks of pay-for-performance programs remain highly inadequate. So these guys have been at it longer than we have. It doesn't work. It's too complicated. You know, you just don't know when you're giving people, paying them for a spit. And this is a little bit in quality. We talk about it as the Hawthorne effect, where you're focusing on one thing, then something else doesn't get taken care of. So when you apply these pay-for-performance standards. So my suggestion, if you actually had a healthcare system instead of a sickness care non-system, would you would pay for system performance. you would allow us to compete against disease and disability, not against the group across town that has the same type of bundled payment that you do. Let us compete against disease and disability as clinicians. That's and reward us, reward the system as a whole. You want to give us, you know, a performance bonus to our overall pay as clinicians within the healthcare system, and then we can all not worry about who has the sick patients. We can all just worry about making sure we give the best care to everybody that we can. I won't diverge, and maybe others in this, I'm hoping they will. We'll talk more about the sociodemographic underlying causes of health and disease, which a healthcare system isn't ever going to get to. You know, we're not talking about the structural things that are out there in society that make people sick to begin with. And the healthcare system all by itself can't necessarily address that. Only a just polity, a just set of politics can create that. So it sounds like, you know, pay people to do better work and they'll do better work. It sounds pretty simple. But they've been largely disappointing. Again, and this is from JAMA looking at these things. One argument, neither the right set of incentives or the right set of metrics has been identified. People have been doing this for a while and it's not working, okay? I'm not sure it's that, all right? But that's the JAMA saying it. Another explanation, far less attention, is the right set of patients. So don't you love this? The right set of patients hasn't been identified for targeted efforts. All you bad patients out there, you know. This has nothing to do with poverty and injustice. No, this is all about you bad people who overuse healthcare. You know, believe me, we use less healthcare than other countries that are the same, and they spend half as much as we do to get better results. All right, so JAMA again. We need to test targeted pay for performance. And they say it may be worth the effort. I mean, how many times are we going to go down this path? Let me talk about patient incentives. So this is that we will be better shoppers on the exchange. Believe me, I've tried to shop with my master's in public health, my MD, my prior insurance experience, helping my patients go on and try to be a navigator for them, and it is not easy to make sure that you're getting people what they need on the exchanges. That's the way they're designed now. I mean, my idea of an exchange would be more like Medicare, one set of comprehensive benefits. You're a citizen, you're in. Done. You know? Hey. Yeah, well, I'm just saying that's how Medicare did it. We can argue about citizens. I happen to believe we should just cover everybody. That's my oath. If your brain is working, your heart is working, I'm going to take care of you. We dug Saddam Hussein out of a rat hole, we fixed him up, and then we hung him. And our doctors did it, right? We don't. Do you want us to judge you as physicians whether you're worthy of our care? Is that what you want from doctors, to make a judgment about you and make the decision about what kind of care you get based on our personal judgment of your worth? I'm sorry. You're a human being. I don't care what you've done. You're sick. We're going to fix you up. That's our job. That's how that ought to be. That's the tradition. That's the Samaritan tradition of healthcare, and it ought to stay that way. So how about higher co-payments, deductibles, health savings accounts? These are all these other marketeer ideas. So shopping for price. This is a pretty conservative health economist here, Paul Ginsberg. Greater price transparency might help curb rising costs, but many overstate the likely magnitude. We're twice as expensive, guys. The most exaggerated notion of shopping for price is that it might reduce healthcare costs by 1% to 2% that I've read. And this is from a conservative economist. That isn't going to be enough to keep us from bankrupting the country on the path we're on. So we've got to look where the other costs are, primarily the administrative complexity of the system. Patient incentives. So here's some stuff about out-of-pocket costs, which I think is this data is beginning to develop and evolve as well, that out-of-pocket costs are harmful to people. You know, if you don't have good coverage for essential medications, you're going to end up in the emergency room and in the hospital with your congestive heart failure, your asthma, your COPD, your congestive heart failure, your coronary artery disease, your diabetes. You're going to end up in there if we don't give you the tools to control your disease. And putting co-payments in their hands isn't going to make them smarter. So the burden of out-of-pocket costs actually are looming larger than some of our treatment side effects for these people. In other words, the fact that you can't afford the care may end up causing you to pay more. Cost-sharing trends, again, the more you cost-share, the worse your adherence, the worse your outcomes. This is a literature review, actually it's published in Journal of Pharmacy and Therapeutics, mostly looking at copayments for drugs, and basically showed that across this literature review, people who have to pay out of pocket end up with worse outcomes. And so the question is that incentive, which is to be smarter about your use of care, working? And the answer is it isn't working the way we think it should. It's keeping people from getting the care they need. Good old Mayo Clinic, I love this one. This is about health savings accounts. If you're generally healthy, you might want a health savings account. On the other hand, if you think you might need expensive medical care, don't do that. Right, so here it is again. Segment the population. Cherry pick, lemon drop. If you might be sick, you don't want to mess around with HSAs. It could really be a problem for you when it comes the time you all of a sudden realize you're sick instead. So I love that. Yeah, an HSA might not be your best option. Oh, you better believe it won't be. A good way to lose your house and anything else you might have saved up. Another article on health savings accounts, high deductible health insurance plans. And again, implications for those who do have high medical costs or low incomes or happen to be uninsured. So what we know is it's unlikely to significantly reduce the number of uninsured. How could it when it doesn't even produce reasonable outcomes? But anyway, the bottom line on this whole thing is that, you know, only those with high incomes are likely to benefit from HSAs, which is exactly why the people who run the country who have high incomes are putting HSAs in place. It's one more place to hide their money. To keep it from being taxed. So you can use it as a tax-leveraged savings account, even if you're high income. And if you don't know your healthcare needs are modest, you know, you can hide money there and let it grow. And they're even allowing some rollover of some of this stuff now. There was some limits on it in the past. So again, the experts are saying the ability of HSAs to reduce system-wide spending is very limited. Very limited. Potential to increase the segmentation of healthcare risk in private insurance markets, now that's not limited. So, you know, people are going to cherry pick and lemon drop again. And so it's just going to exaggerate that whole idea. So you're giving people out-of-pocket costs, trying to make them wiser consumers. All it does is lead to more cherry picking, lemon dropping, bankruptcy, and it mainly advantages the rich. So, I'm almost done here. The market ideologues, their conclusion based on the preceding evidence. You've got square peg of healthcare, and you've got the round hole of market forces. Their answer is, get me a bigger hammer. Isn't going to work. So, here's what most of my colleagues and physicians, if not all, and Physicians for National Health Program and other colleagues that work in APHA on health reform think. We need a single-payer, tax-based system like an improved expanded Medicare for all. Marketplace medicine is not going to work. And we can just walk across these comparisons. Single payer would be fair. Everybody would contribute. Everybody would benefit. Marketplace medicine, rationed by ability to pay. Single payer would be generous. You'd have generous coverage, broad coverage, first dollar coverage. Market medicine, wasteful. Inclusive versus exclusionary, cherry picking, lemon dropping. Especially the sick versus avoiding the sick. Choice and autonomy versus restrictions, narrow networks. Access to care wherever, whoever you choose as a patient or doctor for referral, barriers on their side. Trust versus rules. Accountability versus unregulated. Commitment versus flexibility. Longer time horizons versus trade secrets. You know, does Macy's tell Gimbel's about how I improve the quality of care? Public and open and sharing with academic or professional values versus commercial or near criminal values. So I think it's an easy choice. I don't think Obamacare is going to get us there. The question is what do we do to get us there? And maybe our next two speakers can talk about what we can do to get there. So my conclusion, how about health care with everybody in and nobody out? Single payer, improved Medicare for all. I think that is the square hole. And we've got the square peg that will fit it. So thanks. We'll save questions for the end. And I did have a concluding slide. And I thought this was interesting because we use this, and I forgot to throw this in. You can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted all the other possibilities. Okay? So we have. We have exhausted all the other possibilities. We better get busy putting a single-payer system in place. But what was remarkable about this is I thought this was Winston Churchill. I've always been told it was Winston Churchill who said this. And when I looked it up, it turned out maybe it was Abba Iban, who was Israeli prime minister, I think. And then Iban, when he got asked, he actually said he thought he heard it on a tour through Ireland, that some Irishman may have said it to him. So this may be, you know, like nobody knows who wrote the Irish song Danny Boy either. I don't know why the Irish don't step up and take credit for their creativity. But I still think it's true, so thanks. Let me introduce our next speaker. And I think it's Howard. Yeah, sure. Again, the only question is, will we have trouble with seeing slides, Martha? So it's hard to introduce somebody like Howard. Howard has done so many things and written extensively on the politics and policy, not only here in the U.S. but internationally, on the deeper reach on this, which is the social constructs, the political constructs, that result in systems and resistance to change in systems to provide people the care they need. So he's currently at the University of New Mexico, is that right, Howard? And also has worked with Robert Wood Johnson, and I believe those are still activities that continue. So Howard, why don't you come on up, and it's Howard Waitzkin.